Welcome to the Fearless Women Podcast. We're inspiring conversations for the unafraid. I'm Janice McDonald, founder of the Beacon Agency, author, and global champion for women. Why am I making this show? Because I want to share the inspiring stories of women leaders in business, arts and culture, politics, and more with all of you. Hear how they've chosen to go forward and be bold and make the world a better place, even when it wasn't easy to do. Subscribe now wherever you find podcasts. Welcome to the Ambassador of France in Ottawa, Madame Karine Rispal. And welcome to the Fearless Women community with listeners from all over the world, in Europe, including France and so many other countries. I'm honored to have you in the studio with us today, Ambassador.
Good morning.
Good morning. Let's talk about Canada. So you've had a chance to live in many exciting places around the world. New York, London, of course, France, and now you're posted here in Canada. So had you been to Canada before your posting, ever had a chance to visit the country?
Yes, in fact, I had a chance to visit Canada. I was a director for the Americas at the Foreign Affairs Ministers, and I've been visiting Canada with President de la République Hollande and with Prime Minister. So I had a few occasions to not really visit Canada, but to be in Canada.
And now that you're living here, anything that has surprised you or is unexpected about Canada or perhaps about Canadians?
Yeah, I think that you never know a country until you live in the country. So I think I knew everything about Canada, but still you are always surprised by the vastness of the country, its diversity, the extreme weather, and even if everybody tells you that winters are very strong and difficult, it's true. And I've been not surprised, but really touched by the kindness of Canadian people. And that's really true.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your absolutely spectacular residence on Sussex Drive in Ottawa. It has sweeping views of the Ottawa River, and there's also a famous room that everyone wants to see. Can you share some of the history of this special place?
The idea was really for France to have a spectacular building because we wanted to show Canada how close friends we were and we are. So the idea was really to have something special. So from the beginning, the building was meant to be the French embassy. And the first stone dates from 1936. Mm-hmm. And the old building was completed in 1939, which is kind of strange time when you think about it. Mm-hmm. And it was not just about, you know, building an embassy. It was really a piece of art. So the architect brought with him some French artists, painters, sculptors, and they did everything together. So that's what is really special about this embassy. And the other thing is this famous room, which is the Birch Room. Mm-hmm. And once again, the architect had no idea at the beginning that he would put some birch on the walls of this fumoir because it was a smoking room. But after a few weeks of having been in Canada, he decided that it would be the perfect material. And it's true, it's a very unique room. It's very warm, very cozy, and it's one of my favorite rooms.
It's so beautiful. And again, you have the sweeping views also. Art is in every corner of that residence.
Yeah, and we have an amazing dining room as well with a huge painting on the wall. So, yeah, it's a very unique place. And it's so unique that I really like to open this house, this building, to people. And we are part of Les Portes Ouvertes d'Ottawa. And last year, 1,500 people came to visit the embassy. So, yeah, it really belongs to Ottawa.
That welcoming spirit is so appreciated and reflected, as you've indicated, in how many people are interested in seeing this spectacular building that, you know, you drive past. And now they have a greater sense of what actually is happening inside there in terms of the beauty and the art and the whole feeling of France kind of emanating from that building. Coco Chanel once said, "The most courageous act is still to think for yourself aloud." What's the last thing you've done that's scared you or made you feel fearless, kind of that challenge in front of you, and how did you overcome it?
Well, it's a difficult question because I think that I am more scared when it comes to my family, my children, than when it comes to me. Maybe asking to be ambassador in Canada was, in a way, a little bit of scary thing to do because it was new and you never know how it's going to be. Mm-hmm. Turns out that it's okay. And maybe another situation was when I ran the marathon, New York Marathon.
Wow.
Because I think that the night before, you are still very anxious about how you're going to complete and run for 42 kilometers. But no, I think that I'm more anxious for my, you know, family, for the kids, when they have an exam or when they're looking for a job than for me.
Yes, our classic mother stuff.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So running a marathon, amazing. A lifelong runner?
Yes.
Still running?
Yeah.
Amazing. So that's an epic undertaking. What is it that you said to yourself the night before when you think about that next morning? How am I going to do it?
Well, I'm a runner because I think it keeps me sane. That the unique moment where I am with myself and I like to be outside and there is a special feeling of freedom.
Agree.
When you run, I don't have my cell phone. I don't have anybody around.
Music?
Yeah, music. Yeah, okay. But that's it. And when I have some difficult decisions to take or, I don't know, a speech to deliver, that's a moment where I can think. So I like it very much. And yeah, running a marathon takes a lot of training. Mm-hmm. So you are out in the morning at 5 a.m. and you run for 2 hours, 3 hours. So, I mean, the day before you're like, I haven't done all this for nothing, so I have to do it.
Yeah.
And of course, and especially when it's the first time, you never know if you're going to be able to finish it. Because 42 kilometers, it's
far.
A long way.
It's far.
So you never know if you're going to collapse or how you're going to feel. So maybe that was the situation where I was really anxious. But like all the other runners, all my friends were like me.
But you prepared as well.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So you have some sense that it's going to go well. But to your point, if you've never done it before, you think, have I prepared enough? Running in Ottawa, though, in the winter, and it's been a long one, that can be challenging.
It's challenging. So I tried to run as much as I could, but it was really icy. Mm-hmm. So finally, I bought a treadmill.
Yes. Yeah. Because sometimes it has just been unpleasant to run outside. So you have a master's degree in law. You started your career at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in 1986. Take us back to that time, to the starting days of your career. What was it like? And tell us, you know, as a woman in diplomacy, having a seat at the table now, how is it? Is it different? Do we bring a different perspective? Why is it needed?
Well, when I joined the ministry, it's true, it was a very male environment. I think we've made lots of progress. Mm-hmm. But I spent my three last years in high school in a school, an only boys school. So at the time we were 5 girls for 30 boys.
Wow.
So I was kind of used, you know, to this kind of environment. Mm-hmm. And when I went to Sciences Po and to L'École Nationale d'Administration, it was very male dominant. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was kind of normal to be surrounded by men. And I don't know, it was another time. So there were some sexism, some maybe words or, I don't know, digest who today we wouldn't accept. Mm-hmm. But at the time, it was different. And I don't know, I was a young good-looking girl, so I was good at what I was doing. So it was kind of easy because, you know, people notice me. So every time they propose me a new job, so it was kind of easy until the time when you are really at the top.
Yes.
And when I became a director, very often we had meetings with all the directors, and we were like one or two women around the table. Mm-hmm. And you can notice that there are still some stereotypes, that it's more difficult to make your point, that there is this kind of body language of men around the table, and they are not really laughing at what you say, but, you know, kind of smile.
Yeah, or smirking.
And, mm-hmm. Yeah, and you have to be better prepared. Mm-hmm. You have to be more efficient. You don't have a strong voice, so sometimes it's not that easy. But I didn't really suffer from it. I've been kind of lucky, I think. Having women around the table makes a huge difference. I think that women are very brave. I think we say what we have to say. Mm-hmm. I think that we are more willing to compromise. I think we bring a different mindset. We are kind of creative. We are able to think out of the box. So it brings diversity.
Absolutely. And we know, whether that's around a boardroom table, really in any environment, when we have diverse points of view, we're going to get better outcomes. Absolutely. Yeah. So take us back then to the 10-year-old you. What were you interested in? How did you spend your time? So you're a runner now. Were you running even in those early days? Was that a passion? What were you like?
I was really a tomboy. Mm-hmm. So doing a lot of sports. I was a swimmer, doing some competitions, gymnastic. I was riding horses. I was a dancer. So every day I was practicing kind of sport. And I was not girlish at all. So my sister is 2 years older than me, mm-hmm. and she was really girlish, and I was not. And I remember that during the holidays, we spent holidays with my grandmother and my cousins. And at the time, I had very long, thick, curly hairs. And every Friday night before the parents arrived for the weekend, my sister was trying to comb through my hair, and it was a disaster. And I was screaming and shouting. And I was really like, yeah, a boy.
Yeah, just sports.
Oh, yeah, sports.
Just outside.
And, yeah, and outside. And yeah, absolutely.
And so it's no surprise that you run marathons and spend your days, you know, outside in the environment when time allows.
Yeah, but I came to running later in my life. I think running is not a sport for young people. Mm. And marathon are not for young people because it's really in your head. So
yes. You
really need to be strong in your head more than, you know, in a very good shape.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it is. It's a head game to do the distance, isn't it?
Yeah.
Amazing. So you're married with 4 children. We heard that, you know, they're on your mind, and certainly you have a very successful career. What has been your approach to career and family and the competing demands of both? And when you share that, any advice to younger women setting out on their career, trying to have that balance of family and a fulfilling career?
Well, I think my advice would be to never give up on anything. And I've always been very pragmatic. So after my studies, I had the choice to join the Foreign Affairs Ministry. I had my doubts because I knew that it's a difficult job, that you have to live abroad, mm-hmm. so it's difficult to build a family. But I was really interested into diplomacy, so I was like, okay, let's try. And if at one point I see that it's really difficult to combine my job and my family, then I will have to make choices. And it happened that I never had to do these choices, and I was able to do both. I get some help mm-hmm. from my parents because they were working people, and they stopped working when my sister and I had children. They didn't do it on purpose, but it happened at the same time. And they were such fantastic grandparents. So having grandparents around, parents around that can, you know, when the babysitter is sick, they can come in 5 minutes, that's really valuable. I think that without them, I wouldn't have been able to do what I did, having four children, working for ministers.
Traveling the world.
Traveling.
Yes.
But then you have to be in a very good health and you need to be prepared not to sleep a lot. Because the weekends were really tiring. And every Sunday night I was like, oh, thanks God, tomorrow is a Monday.
And so given your interest in sports, et cetera, they must have had many activities themselves.
Oh, yeah, because, you know, when you're a parent, you want to be a perfect parent. So you want them to have, you know, music lessons.
Yes.
You want them to practice judo, to practice tennis, to go to the ballet. So, yeah, you try to be a perfect parent. And it happens that you're not always successful, but that's another story. So we were very, very active during the weekends, trying to do everything, going to museums. And we had the chance to live in very nice cities.
Yes.
Interesting cities. In Paris, in New York, in London. It was kind of fun, but tiring.
Yeah, but tiring. Absolutely. So you've received, and when we're talking about this spectacular career of yours, you've received significant recognition in your career with national awards, including as an officer of the National Order of Merit, among others. And women sometimes shy away from the spotlight, and this can have a negative impact on their careers. Why, in your view, does recognition matter, particularly for women in their careers?
Well, I think that recognition matters for everyone. You want to be recognized because you're doing a good work, that because you're good at what you do, because you're involved, because you do what you believe is good. So it's not really the official recognition that matters to me. But very often people ask me, oh, you're the first female French ambassador, so what does it take to be a female French ambassador? And my answer is always, you know, I don't want to be recognized as the first female French ambassador. I just want to be recognized as a very good ambassador. So yeah, recognition is key, but not only for women. But it's true that women are shy and maybe they are not used to ask for any recognition. And so that's another biais that we have to fight. And in France, we have different kind of awards, La Légion d'honneur, Le Mérite, Les Arts et Lettres. And there is a strong policy, and it's a recent one, which really forces us to propose women. So the same number of women as men. So when we make proposals to have all these people awarded, we need to have the same number of women and of men. And sometimes it's really difficult to find women.
Because they don't have the credentials? Or is it because they're not well-networked or they actually lack the skills or the requirements that...
Because often they are not on the top positions.
Okay.
So when you want to award the dean of the university, you award the dean.
Right.
And not necessarily number two or number three. So sometimes, it's a struggle. When, for example, we are looking for women at the head of museums, we don't have so many. So I think it's both. It's what we call the reservoir. And sometimes because women are not at the top, top, top.
Sometimes it's systemic. And sometimes I guess it is pipeline. We just don't have enough in those positions. But then what is the process that is holding them back or pushing them forward? So that's interesting. But I love to hear that there is a specific approach that says, let's have a balanced number on that list, at least what's proposed.
Yeah, because it really forces us to really think out of the box and to go and find all those women.
Yes.
And you have plenty of women.
They're there.
It's just that maybe we won't recognize number one, but number two and number three in a organization, and that's okay.
Absolutely. And we share, of course, it's no surprise, a passion for gender equality. The 30% Club organization, who's a sponsor of this podcast, they launched in the UK in 2010 and now expanded to 12 other countries. And their organization believes that gender balance on boards and senior management encourages better leadership and governance and all around better board performance. And you chair the High Council for Equality Between Men and Women and are the Senior Officer for Gender Equality at your Foreign Affairs Ministry. So please share with us the work of the Council and why it matters. And in your view, because you're so passionate about this, what will it take to up the numbers?
I think that we have to start at a very early age. If you don't educate the boys, if you don't educate the girls at a very, very young age, if you don't break all the stereotypes, if you are still buying dolls for the girls, we won't make any progress. So we really need to break all these stereotypes, break the barriers, and make all the girls think that they can do whatever they want. Mm-hmm. And there is absolutely no reason why they shouldn't be a doctor, an engineer, a big data person. Mm-hmm. So you have to start at a very young age. Secondly, in France, we have decided to have some quotas. I know it's not very popular in Canada because whenever I talk about quotas, people say, oh, but you know, here in Canada, we think that just by setting up a target and by expressing our will to achieve our target, that's going to be enough. And I think no. I think it's not true. And as you said, I was a senior gender equality person within the ministry. And I belong to lots of selection committee. Mm-hmm. And very often, if you don't have a quota which imposes you to have women, I mean, it's always the same thing. People say, oh, yeah, I mean, when you're looking to nominate an ambassador in a certain country, oh, yeah, yeah, this lady, oh, yeah, yeah, she's great. But, you know, she's young. So she can wait a few years. And this man, on the contrary, you know, is very experienced and skilled diplomat. He had a huge job, so we have to appoint him. So if you don't have, you know, something that really forces you to find women, to think out of the box, then you don't make any progress. And that's what we have been doing within the ministry. And it's true that within maybe 5 or 6 years, we went from 11% of women ambassadors to 26%. Mm-hmm. Because we really had to nominate women. So yes, there were less experience, they were younger, but finally they did very well. So yeah, it's a stretch, but you have to do it.
I agree with you. I would have thought identifying the problem and shining a spotlight on it would be enough. But we've seen how slow progress is. And absolutely, if there are requirements, it's amazing how creative we get when we must. We suddenly, you know, have a very different approach. So is it all briefing documents or do you have time to read for pleasure? And if so, what are you reading right now?
No, I'm a big reader, so I always read a few pages before going to sleep. So that's an old habit, and I cannot go on holidays without 10 books. So now I have a Kindle, so that's make my
You're never
luggage,
without a book.
Yeah, lighter. and I don't like to read one book at a time. So currently I'm reading 3 books. Mm-hmm. So I'm reading Michel Houellebecq, mm-hmm. Serotonin. He's a very well-known French writer. Mm-hmm. I am reading Amin Malouf, Le Naufrage des Civilisations. Okay. And I'm reading as well a book by Siri Ouchvet. You know, she's the wife mm-hmm. of Paul Auster. And her last book is Memories of the Future. And I like her very much. And all our books are always happening in New York. And that's a city that I love. So,
yes.
and I love the way she writes, and I love the way that Paulo Serre writes. Mm-hmm. I love that language. And they're very famous in France as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, speaking about France, what about French style and rules? You know, everyone around the world is so taken with the elegance of French women. Some of the rules we hear, you know, black and brown never mix. Shoes and purse must match except with a cocktail dress or long gown, when the shoes must match the dress instead. No sweatpants. How does a young French woman learn these many French iconic secrets to style? Is it just in the DNA? Did you?
Yes, I think so, because I think I have always known those rules.
Mm-hmm.
About, you know, not mixing this or that color, even if sometimes you can be creative.
Yes.
So maybe it's part of our education, of our DNA. I don't know. I've seen all the women in my families. My mother was, and is still, she's still alive, mm-hmm. a beautiful woman, very mm-hmm. chic. I don't know. Maybe at school, when we were young, we had, you know, this kind of, I was in a Catholic private school. So maybe at the time, yes, we knew these rules. And then, yeah, it's part of who we were.
Yeah. It's just, it's a French woman stands out everywhere, right? It's just so elegant. And it's so different from other countries in the world, it would seem. There's just... je ne sais quoi.
Yeah, you're right. And even if we dress like all the other people at Zara or whatever, mm-hmm. I mean, we don't need to be dressed like by Chanel or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there is something very specific. Yeah. And I think that the Italian women
absolutely
are the same. Yes. So there's a little something, I don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe because we have all these big names and very famous designers and... Coco
yes.
Chanel, and so we have been used to live with all these mm-hmm. unique persons.
Yeah, the appreciation, I think, of the fabric and the craft and all of that is, I think, just embedded in the approach, it would seem. So Canadians, of course, we have a complete love affair with France. It's the number one travel destination for Canadians traveling in Europe. Why do we love France so much? And what's the inside scoop you can give Canadians thinking of traveling to France this summer?
Well, I think that Canadian people love France for the same reason that I love my country. I think it's a beautiful country.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite unique. And it's true that every time I come back to Paris, especially in the morning, you know, when you arrive from the airport, I mean, it's so beautiful. And every time I'm amazed by the beauty of this city, I think it's because of its history, its way of life, its gastronomy. And you can go to the north, you can go to the south, you can go to Paris, you can go to Bordeaux, Lyon. It's this mix of culture, history, way of living, good food, spectacular views. And this makes our country very, very unique. You have all this small, incredible village, and you can find a restaurant where you can eat for 20 euros.
Yes.
And the best, incredible food. So I think it's a mix of a little bit everything.
Mm-hmm.
And we are very fortunate to live in our country.
Absolutely.
But my advice would be, don't look at your guides, but just walk around and look at what surrounds you and just
take
relax,
it all in.
Enjoy
yeah.
it and mm-hmm. Go at a terrace and have a coffee, a croissant, and just relax.
Mm-hmm. Soak it all in. It's beautiful. So final question. What is your dream for Canada ambassador, your dream for France? And as if that's not big enough, how about for the world? What is your dream?
Well, my dream for Canada, it's a difficult question. I'm not Canadian, but I would love to see Canada even closer mm-hmm. to France. So I would love to have more Canadian students coming to France, study in France, and come back here. Because I think that having this kind of experience really bring countries really closer. Mm-hmm. So that would be my dream, because we see more French people coming to Canada than the opposite. So I would love to have a more balanced relation and more Canadian people to France. For France, my dream would be maybe for French people to realize how lucky we are to live in France. I think it's an amazing place. We are very fortunate to live in France. We have a very good health system, a very good education system, beautiful country, lots of, you know, assets. So I would love French people to be happy and to realize that we are really privileged to live in France compared to so many other countries. It's a country of freedom, of democracy. So yeah, that would be my dream. And for the world, of course, a big dream of peace and to see inequalities being reduced. And that's the big theme of our presidency of the G7, how to fight inequalities. And every woman and every man deserves to live in its own country and to be free in its own country. And we know it's not the case. I think that our values are really in danger. And I would also would like to see people really tackle the climate change challenge. I think it's one of our biggest challenge. It will affect our children, all the future generation. We already can see all the effects of climate change, and especially in Canada, but everywhere else in the world. And I'm not sure that we have really taken the measure of what awaits us if we are not doing anything.
An absolute beautiful dream for the world, for France, and for Canada. It has been such a pleasure to have you spend time with us today, Ambassador Karine Rispal, a big thinker, gender equality champion, and woman diplomat who is leading the charge. Thank you so much for joining us here today on the Fearless Women Podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We want our community to grow. Tell your friends, follow us on Instagram, and sign up for our newsletter at fearlesswomenpodcast.com to get the early scoop. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts or in your favorite app. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star rating. I'm Janice McDonald. Stay fearless. Thank you to the 30% Club Canada for your support of the Fearless Women Podcast. The 30% Club believes that gender balance on boards and in senior management not only encourages better leadership and governance, but diversity further contributes to better all-around board performance and ultimately increased corporate performance for both companies and their shareholders. Want to learn more? Visit their website, 30percentclub.org, and select the Canada chapter to find out about membership, supporters, and key resources. Thank you to BDC, the bank devoted exclusively to entrepreneurs, for your support of the Fearless Women Podcast. We love smart companies that want to amplify women's voices. For more information, go to bdc.ca/women.